This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Tom Scholt, and I co-host the channel with Kevin Lindsay. On this episode, I have the great pleasure of finally getting to talk with one of the unsung heroes of cybernetics, whose work has finally begun to receive the critical attention it has long deserved, and upon which I have leaned quite heavily in my own work since I entered this field. With Cybernetics for the Social Sciences, out from Brill in 2021, Bernard Scott has met a long-felt need by authoring a book that shows the foundational relevance of cybernetics for such fields as psychology, sociology, and anthropology. Scott provides user-friendly descriptions of the core concepts of cybernetics, with examples of how they can be used in the social sciences, and explains how cybernetics functions as a transdiscipline that unifies other disciplines and a meta-discipline that provides insights about how other disciplines function. He provides an account of how cybernetics emerged as a distinct field following interdisciplinary meetings in the 1940s, convened to explore feedback and circular causality in biological and social systems, and also recounts how encountering cybernetics transformed his thinking and his understanding of life in general. And so, without any further ado, let's turn to my conversation with Bernard Scott. Bernard Scott, welcome to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. It is such a pleasure to, I finally got to meet you online in a few online conferences over the last years or so, but your work has been so important to my own studies and my own scholarship through previous publications of yours, many gathered in a wonderful book that Edition Echo Realm put out a number of years ago that I would also turn readers to. But it's so wonderful to have a chance to speak with you for a good period of time today. So welcome to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics.
Thank you, Tom. This is my pleasure, and I thank you for your interest.
Absolutely. So we're going to start, although you do cover it in the book to some degree and in some papers as well, because it seems to me that your journey, your discovery of cybernetics and your journey in towards working so intimately with Gordon Pask is absolutely tied into your deep passion for the work. But can you give us a little bit of your academic intellectual biography and how it led you to such a deep engagement with cybernetics?
Yes, I think it's probably important to say at the start that I developed a concept of what it is to be a cybernetician, which has informed my, not just my thinking, but my whole approach to life and living. So it was quite a journey. I started out as an undergraduate in psychology, having decided not to go to medical school. So I wasn't really interested in cutting up bodies. I was more interested in human beings as whole persons. And it was while I was an undergraduate, like I read a couple of books which mentioned cybernetics, but we had a lecturer a new lecturer gave a course on cybernetics. His name was David Stewart, who's still alive, I believe. And he mentioned PASC. He mentioned Bina, McCullough, PASC, and Ashby, and Beer. I think he referred to all of them as geniuses, which I found intriguing. The course I was on had a mix of kind of internships, places to work, going to work for a few months and then coming back to the college. And through his good graces, David Stewart got me a placement for 6 months working with Gordon Pask in Richmond, Surrey, England, not far away from the college, which was one of the main reasons why I wanted to go there, because I didn't wish to travel around England very much. It was very convenient. But I knew little about Pask until I got there. But I was absolutely astonished when I met him, because he was the most, he was certainly the most intelligent, aware person I'd ever met. And his presence was awesome, just to be in the same room as him. He just commanded attention. And, he was, as I say, awesome. And it's working with him that inspired me to take cybernetics really seriously, and indeed to. It gave an entry into understanding psychology better, because up to that point, psychology had been, as an academic discipline, had been quite disappointing. But I read papers. I read his most recent paper of the time and chased up the references in the library. And I became a serious student of psychology and cybernetics, which was wonderful, really, because Not only did it aid me in my studies, I came away with a first-class honours degree in cybernetics, in psychology, but PASC took me on as a research associate when I graduated, and I enrolled to do a PhD under his supervision at Brunel University. So that's the brief background.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And the spirit of his work lives strong in your work, and the ways you've developed it and continue to make it just so accessible is a huge service you've done to scholars like myself and to the whole community. So this book, Cybernetics for the Social Sciences, so this is, wrapped in with the question of, why this book now? What made you decide this was the moment to write this particular book? And so what is it that the social sciences needs that cybernetics can bring it, I guess, which is a theme, obviously, of the whole book. But maybe those two questions are sort of connected. Why this book now? And what is the social sciences, what is the social sciences in need of that cybernetics can bring?
Okay, well, thanks to Gordon Pask and cybernetics and the 10 years I spent with him developing and applying conversation theory, I became interested in not just psychology, but other disciplines, and not least the social sciences, sociology, social psychology, cultural anthropology, not so much economics, but management science and so on. And I could see that cybernetics was a wonderful tool or sort of conceptual framework to use to grasp these other disciplines as in a holistic way. And along the way, I discovered that the a need within the cybernetics community being regularly expressed that there ought to be a good Cybernetics 101, introductory course to cybernetics. And I thought, that's a good idea. Maybe I could contribute to such a thing as the... But as time went by, nothing materialized. But I started formulating in my own mind what I would like to communicate. And because of my interest in the social sciences, as a psychologist, I found a home for me amongst the social cybernetics community. RC51, Research Committee 51 on Social Cybernetics of the International Sociological Association. I found a home where I could express my ideas and learn from other people who were working in sociology and other social sciences. And I saw there was a need. Well, we had a name in the group, still is there in the RC51 group, to spread the good news about cybernetics and systems thinking into sociology at large, which is a rather bold aim, given that you know, there are probably, a few hundred thousand sociologists around the world and a couple of hundred socio-cybernetians. We seem to wear the aim. And I read some sociology books, there were brief references to systems thinking or cybernetics, but nothing particularly accurate or deep. So I thought, it was a good idea to write for that particular audience. And 3 years ago, my friend Chaime Marcello offered to work with Brill Publishing to be editor-in-chief for a series of monographs to do with socio-cybernetics. And I volunteered to write at least one of those. And eventually, after some discussion, we came up with the title Cybernetics for the Social Sciences. So my aim here is to communicate to social scientists at large what cybernetics offers, and on the way say something about systems thinking. And I deliberately made it as non-mathematical as I could, and I tried to make it very user-friendly in terms of how I wrote about things, described things, and so on. Excuse me, I've just had to cancel a Skype call from someone.
Yeah.
Such is the way.
Yeah.
So that was the aim for the book. And basically, I took ideas from a number of papers I'd already written and then edited them together.
Yeah, they're going to try again. They always do, at least once. They think it can't possibly have refused me, and then they must have dropped the call.
Well, I've sent a little message saying busy. Okay. I don't understand what that means.
Great.
So that's the aim of the book. And I also thought it'd be a very useful, possibly an introduction to cybernetics for other people, including those who, like yourself, are already interested in cybernetics. And so it's a contribution to the cybernetics community as well as to the social sciences at large.
Yeah, and it's absolutely done that. I'm well familiar with the lament of wishing there was a suitable introduction to cybernetics, even though there have been books, most famously Ross Ashby's book called An Introduction to Cybernetics. But again, the mathematics start pretty early and they're intense. And even Wiener's book, you know, so I'm not a social scientist per se. I teach theater and I teach in department theater and film, but cybernetics is very much a huge part of the way I teach acting and directing. And so I introduce concepts of cybernetics to my students and they end up asking me that inevitable question. Well, where's a good book to start? You know, and it's always been so hard to do so. And now I've got exactly the text. It's yours for sure. So if you would summarize just as a sort of, I hate the term elevator pitch, but we'll use it, what the offer is, right? So a social scientist says, I've got, 5 minutes. What is it specifically? You say it's a framework through which I can understand or conceptualize or see new things in across the body of social sciences that I can't see without cybernetics. What is it that it provides that is the main offer?
Okay, well, from the beginning, I say that cybernetics plays the role of a transdiscipline, which looks at similarities and differences across disciplines. And it's also a meta-discipline in that it comments on how other disciplines work and structures. It offers a core set of concepts which can bring unity to how we look at the social sciences. So it is, as a transdiscipline, it's enormously useful if you want a broad, comprehensive view of social sciences, indeed of how the world works in toto, because I would certainly not exclude biology from that, nor would I exclude the other the other sciences. So cybernetics is really using the, I think the term was first coined by or used by Warren McCullough, but cybernetics is a transdiscipline. That's what I would offer.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
But I'd also have to say, of course, his main theme is control and communication.
Yeah.
In complex systems.
Yeah. And that control, looking at all of these other disciplines or all of these various phenomena through the lens of control and communication via circular feedback mechanisms provides a kind of unifying way to look at them. Am I in the right direction?
Thank you for elaborating that. As you know, the Macy conferences held in the 40s and 50s brought together the thinkers from many different disciplines who were interested in what became cybernetics. And the title of their conferences was Feedback and Circular Causality in Biological and Social Systems. So it's about the insight, the major insight that was found in the 40s in a number of places. Not that there were some precursors, but in the 40s, people became aware of the ubiquity of the controlled by negative feedback, in particular systems that anticipate, systems that pursue goals, and so on. And they saw how this could be applied across the board to biological and social systems in principle. And that work has continued, thankfully, in various ways.
Mm-hmm. So you provide a snapshot of your life in cybernetics, which is wonderful, and then the story of cybernetics, including a sort of sense of decline and then renewal. What do you think is leading to a renewal in cybernetics?
I'm not quite sure at the moment, Tom. It's very encouraging. As you know, the decline was largely because of the sub-discipline of artificial intelligence, which I've always seen as being part of cybernetics, mm-hmm. came to the fore and got major funding in the 70s onwards because of its possible applications in defence. And the more softer aspects of cybernetics were screened out. I mean, they got very little. I mean, Pask, who I worked with, quite major funding from the United States military in various ways. It's because of their interest in training and human learning. But when this new emphasis on research having to be relevant for defense, very clearly, mm-hmm. the funding dried up.
Right. This is the famous Mansfield Amendment.
Yes, that's correct. There was a turning away from cybernetics. There had always been a growing lack of interest in that the major disciplines like biology and engineering and so on, not so much the social sciences, but the other sciences, took what they found interesting in cybernetics and just absorbed it into their own disciplines. They were already quite well established with theories and methods, and cybernetics just added to them. And they didn't take on board the broader transdisciplinary aspects. What we saw then was in the 70s, beginning with the past paper you already referred to about extending the meaning of goal, in which he discusses the difference between what he calls taciturn systems and language-oriented systems, which begins a major emphasis on the social human beings with language-oriented systems, and he articulates what are the challenges for we humans to be studying humans. That was quickly followed by Heinz von Förster and his distinction between first and second order cybernetics, where first order cybernetics is the study of observed systems, which is just standard science, basically, study an object, study a system, and the study of observing systems, which includes the observer himself, human beings, and which necessarily, logically, is reflexive, self-referential, and carries with it clear ethical implications. And alongside those two, we also have Humberto Maturana and his wonderful work on the biology of cognition, in which he too clearly places the human observer centrally there as the as a constructor of the theories that he's articulating, whilst at the same time, Umberto presents a theory of the biological and sets out the implications for what that means if you are a biological system, a human being doing science. And this is a wonderful story that I encourage everyone to try to get to grips with. So those were the main threads that kept cybernetics going, and Pascal's so interest in the field of architecture and design. Certainly von Foerster was instrumental in spreading ideas about cybernetics into education and others of the soft disciplines. So there was a kind of a period of bare survival.
Mm-hmm.
There's a paper from PASS from the early 80s where it says, where cybernetics can be found. Mm-hmm. An institution in the UK, and he mentions the BCL. I don't think it existed anymore. But he mentions two or three, four places in North America, and that's about it.
Yeah.
So it was very threadbare for a while, but there seemed to be a renewal. I'm not quite sure how and when, but in the late 80s, early 90s. A new generation came along of many of them social scientists who began to take a real interest in what both systems thinking and cybernetics had to offer. And since then, there has been the gradual renaissance as your generation, as there are many in your generation now across the world who are interested in cybernetics. And I'm very, very thankful about that. So my little book is hopefully going to power that renaissance a bit more.
Absolutely. I certainly am determined to get it into the hands of folks who I think might be open to its messages and as a way to continue to do that. The absence of cybernetics departments, of course, you did your PhD at Brunel, which was, one of the places that actually offered a PhD in cybernetics, and those places have vanished. Except now there is a new graduate school of cybernetics in Australia. So it's actually, gotten to the point where not only is there still interest in it, but an official accreditation in cybernetics is now finding its way back to academia. So,
yes, I'm aware. I don't know the details, but I'm aware that across the world, there are quite a number of institutions or centers for research which incorporate cybernetics into their titles. That's all to the good.
The fourth part of the book is key concepts in cybernetics, which we won't go through at the moment, although some of those concepts, of course, will come up throughout our conversation. But if ever there was a glossary that we needed, this is it, in terms of really accessible definitions of the key concepts of cybernetics. It's a wonderful chapter. And so, I'm going to recommend this whole book to lots of folks, but at the very least, my students will be getting, will be being asked to read this chapter because it really does go through the really key concepts in such an accessible fashion. But it's time for us to talk a little more specifically, I think, about Gordon Pask, your great mentor and someone whose, of course, his name has come up many, many times on this podcast and who had such an impact on those who studied with him, Ranulf Glanville, Paul Pangaro, yourself. Can you begin to sketch in a little bit about conversation theory for us and its particular contribution to cybernetics and the social sciences writ large?
Okay. The way to appreciate conversation, we're talking about Gordon Pask's conversation theory. And there are other people who write about conversation, study conversation and so on, social constructionists and whatever. You can trace Pask's interests right to the very beginning of his work when he as an inventor, he was building machinery, and we're talking going back to the 50s now, which would adapt to or interact with human beings. And amongst those were some adaptive teaching machines. And Pask likened that interaction between the human learner and the adaptive system as conversational in form. And in fact, those are the roots where he develops a kind of logical structure for what a conversation looks like between a learner and a teacher. But at the same time, he was alive to the fact that in some sense, at least, both systems are self-organizing systems, which together, as they converse, form a kind of a larger whole, which is self-organizing. And he used those insights to write about some of the fundamental concepts of cybernetics. In 1960, or 59, there's a paper called Natural History of Networks. And he says, he talks about the challenges of interacting or learning about self-organizing systems in general. And he says it's like being a natural historian. When you go into the forest or onto the savannah, and you want to study animals and their behavior, you end up with essentially having a conversation with them. There's a kind of social interaction arises. So that's kind of the roots of conversation theory from the scientific approach, and also from the natural world. So again, generalizing from that, we can say that the roots of conversation arise in the interaction amongst any organisms that are part of a community. So those mm-hmm. are the roots. But he developed while I was with him, he developed a formal theory, or what he called conversation theory. The name came out, I think, 72 or 69, something like that. And he set out an agenda of what this conversation theory of his would cover. And it brought together all his previous thinking and a lot more. With Pask, I worked on mainly on educational projects, building what are now called learning environments, which would, in quotes, converse with the student to help the student get to grips with the body of subject matter. It was a very formal theory in terms of analysing the structure of subject matter and studying different styles of learning and conceptualisation, which was Pask's term for the cognition that learners have as they are learning. Now, as always, Pask as a cybernetician was generalising from our particular research activities. So there are a number of places where you can see his ideas broadening. And I should say that it wasn't really until I wrote the book and was well into writing the book that I realised just how important the broader sense of conversation theory as a way of studying the social taken from Pask forms a thread through the book. It really does play a central role in the various chapters, or conversation theory does. So his first major book on conversation is called Conversation, Cognition and Learning. So that focuses very much on the research we did together. But it's a theory of cognition, it's a theory of learning and teaching, it's a theory of knowledge structuring, and it's a general theory of social activity, human social activity, conversation.
Mm-hmm. And it's got, again, that ethical implicit ethics into it as well, in terms of the autonomy of the conversational partners and the ways they literally turn together, you know, conversare as the root of conversation, this turning together. And I remember in one of Pask's papers, his drawing a distinction between communication, which he thought of as a one-way transmission, I am telling you this, versus conversation, which can become the mutual construction of a shared understanding, starting from maybe an asynchronicity, a place where we don't understand each other, and then coming to a place of synchronicity where we do understand each other, and there becomes room for agreement, but which of course can still include the agreement to disagree. And okay. So it seems that it actually sits inside even theories like Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed, in that the learner and the teacher are turning together and understanding each other's conceptual schemas, etc., in a way that's much less top down, much less unidirectional, and has a kind of ethical dimension to it. Is that, would you agree with my assessment in that way?
That's fair enough. I mean, the distinction PASS makes is between, as you say, any sort of interaction between humans, which is basically just a signaling operation, an imperative, a command or a request for someone to do something, just as, you know, as you speak to a call center operator over the phone. There's no real sharing of concepts. There's no real learning about the other going on. So he does say that Ranulf says something very simple. Ranulf Blanfield says something very similar. So yes, we're back to the idea of two self-organizing systems, two human beings, in this case, coming together, and not synchronicity. The word is synchrony.
Mm-hmm.
You become synchronized with another human as soon as you, to use the terminology of sociology, as soon as you have the double contingency of expectations about expectations at work, that each is expecting the other to participate in a conversation, and then you start to share your concepts, and you have, by being synchronized, you are sharing a reality. You're beginning to construct a reality together, in which literally you are sharing the same space-time kind of world. Whereas up to that point, who knows where you are or where you've been or what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I are at the moment synchronized to some extent. Mm-hmm. Our brain-body systems are synchronized. I'm computing you, you're computing me, and I'm computing what you are computing about me, and vice versa, as best we can. And when our conversation is finished, we'll go our own ways, and I will disappear into another realm, as will you. But we'll carry the conversation with us, and next time, should we encounter each other, the conversation will be picked up and continue. We will synchronize again and continue the conversation. In the meantime, we will have been conversing with each other in imagination. I will carry Tom Schulte with me, as I already had you to some extent inside me, but I'm learning about you all much more now, and vice versa. So you'll become part of who I am, and I will to some extent already continue to be or become even more of what you are. But
yeah, absolutely.
This is where we come into PASS terminology, which confuses many people. And he talks about psychological individuals.
Great. This is where I wanted to go next. This is great. Okay. Wonderful.
Well, the thing to appreciate here is that PASS understands that individual human beings, as persons, our thinking is conversational in form. We are conversing with ourselves, and we're having imaginary conversations with our social world that we have internalized. So I can still think about Pask and have conversations with him. I learn things from him. If I think about him and what happened, and my old teachers, my friends, my family, they're all the population that is me. But, from Bob Dylan's latest album, we have his opening song.
Yes.
I am multitudes.
I contain multitudes, absolutely.
Which I understand is a quotation from Ovid. Bob's a bit of a scholar, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Whitman used the phrase as well.
Oh, well, then in that case, it's probably possibly more Whitman than Ovid.
Yeah.
Bob got from Ovid the phrase, beyond here lies nothing.
Yes, that's right. Wow, this is great. So now my P individual of Bernard Scott is now including Bob Dylan, which you and I could do a whole other hour on Bob Dylan, it turns out. So anyway, that's fantastic.
Anytime, Tom.
Really. Oh, beautiful. Oh, wonderful. Okay.
I'm a pioneer of Bob in that I saw his 1965 concert at the Albert Hall in the UK.
Oh my goodness! Like, so does that mean you're in the audience in Pennebaker's film "Don't Look Back"? Basically,
yes.
Oh my goodness! All right. Okay. Well, you and I will have to have another couple hours on that. So,
the point now we've got the idea that we are multitudes. Each of us has a multitude of perspectives and conversations, whatever. PASS calls that psychological individual. His next major insight is to recognize that as we become synchronized, we form a, if you like, a higher order or a larger, more complex individual, psychological individual. So our conversation is also the we of us is conversational in form. And then you have this kind of fractal structure of P-individuals upon P-individuals upon P-individuals. So you and I are a P-individual together. Someone who listens to this tape becomes P-individuated with us, forms a larger conversation as they think about what we're saying. And then we go back and I talk to my friends about Tom Scholte and our conversation. I talk to my family. And the P-individual, the conversations upon conversations just proliferate. And in no time at all, you have the possibility of a whole culture being, as it were, infected by or influenced by the conversation that we're having. It may be the book I've written, it may be a paper you write, maybe some talk. But this is how ideas spread. It's a conversational activity. This is basic interaction, social interaction, which as humans we capture in various ways through our texts, our recordings, and our remembering, our own personal ways of understanding and interpreting what's happened between us. So we may take a particular topic like Bob Dylan and develop our shared understandings of him and then find there are perhaps some differences where you say, well, you don't like or enjoy or understand his gospel work. And I say, no, I find it that really significant, important and profound. So we come up with agreements and disagreements and we can agree to disagree over certain things. But we walk away with understandings about each other, understandings about what we think each other understands on these topics. And that's conversation in its healthiest forms. You know, humans learning about each other, humans learning about, well, animals in general, living systems in general, learning about each other in relatively harmonious ways.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so this important distinction between P individuals and M individuals. So P individuals as the psychological individual and M individual as the mechanical individual, and the P individual being this self-reproducing, well, literally like a mesh, right? Talk about past entailment meshes, a interconnected set of entailed, mutually entailed concepts that is reproduced every time we think of it, right? So every time I think of Bob Dylan, that's reproduced, yeah? And that is a P individual, yeah?
Yes, we're going forward a bit. Yeah, we haven't mentioned the past concept of the mechanical individual.
Okay, I'll ask you to take us there then.
Basically, what Pascal is a cybernetician. He wants to understand the social, and he finds it convenient. Well, right from the beginning of his work on cognition, he makes a distinction between the cognitive system, all that thinking, and the process, as it were, and the processor, which is embodying that thinking. So essentially, this is roughly as people informally talk about mind and body. When he develops conversation theory is his notion of a cognitive system. The thinking part becomes this P individual we've talked about, the psychological individual, which is embodied in a mechanical individual. This is general term for basically a brain-body system such as we have. And it's I like to call it an analytic distinction, because we're not saying that humans are less than whole persons, and we're just saying that the distinctions we make between the mind stuff and the body stuff are distinctions we make.
Mm-hmm.
And we use them for certain purposes. And in this case, we want to develop better understandings of what it is to be human. So we make the distinction between the psychological individual as a whole system, which renews itself moment by moment, day by day, and the mechanical individual, the biological brain-body system, which renews itself biologically, autopoietically, day by day. And the two systems are obviously inseparable in reality. You cannot have a pure individual which is not embodied, and you cannot have a conscious human being who is not an embodied pure individual.
Mm-hmm.
You might have a dead body or an unconscious body, but if a body is unconscious, you cannot converse with the person. This is where the word conscious really comes from.
Mm.
It's when doctors interrogate a body that's lying there and say, "Are you awake? Can you speak to me? Wake up!" Mm. And they flash lights in the body's eyes, this object, and then the object's eyes wake up and it says, "Where am I?" At that point, there's consciousness, and that the two persons, the doctor and the patients, are knowing something with each other. They are conscio, they're knowing with each other.
Mm.
And it's this consciousness as knowing with is central to past thinking as well.
Mm-hmm.
Within as aspects of P individuals, the knowing with, either within the individual person or within the conversation between persons. But all the time you have, the dynamics, the biological dynamics of the brain-body system, which accounts for the basic awareness which all living systems possess to some degree. We're all aware to some degree, except when we're asleep or dead,
mm-hmm.
basically. And it's a dynamic which has a drive to it. It means that we are certainly amongst the higher mammals and many other species, we have what some psychologists have referred to as a curiosity drive, or past refers to as a need to learn. We're always, mm-hmm. we explore our worlds, our environments. We add to our knowledge of the world we are in through experiencing it, exploration. And if there's something we come across that we don't understand, we resolve the uncertainty as best we can. And once we resolve some uncertainty, we start looking for more. We
mm-hmm.
Use Ashby's terms, living systems are eaters of variety. We look
yes.
at variety. And if you think about a small infant crawls around a room, playing with things, looking at things, tasting things, handling things, this is a wonderful example of what it means to be a eating variety. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and I think one of the things that maybe people might struggle with to initially grasp, but what to me is one of the great advantages of Pask's system of thought, if I can call it that, and we'll compare it to another one that you compare it to in a moment, the idea that a P individual can be made up or can be instantiated rather across a number of M individuals. So for instance, the idea of people, say, sitting in a church together, there's a gathering of M individuals, but if we are sharing a set of concepts that is whatever faith, oh, I guess I've said church, so I guess I'm talking Christianity in this instance, we share a set of concepts that we are being mobilized in this activity we're doing that we're knowing with each other. You've got a gathering of M individuals, but in a sense, a shared P individual is being instantiated by us together. Yes. Is that an accurate rendering?
Just as with you and I, we have our bodies, our brain body systems, which are temporarily synchronized as we converse, and we are creating a Tom and Bernard P individual, our conversation. If you have a group of, if you have people engaged in social activity together, then there may be any number of brain-body systems involved. But together, certainly from the perspective of an external observer, you can say, oh, look, they are conversing together, they are one social system. But the key factor here is that the, you know, individuals are self-referential. They're in awareness of what they are doing and saying. And what makes a gathering of human beings, a P individual, a psychological individual, a conversation, a social system in my terms, is that they construe themselves as such. You know, they when they sit in church, they are saying, we, you know, we are members of the organization. If you go to work with your colleagues, you all talk to each other. Everybody knows, in the sense that they, you know, they're conceptualizing themselves as members of the organization. That's what brings them together. That that's what makes the organization fundamentally a social system. And this is a very different concept from, for example, that of Nicholas Luhmann.
Which is where I was going next. You're always one step ahead of me. That was where I was going to go next.
Well, there are also other many cyberdishes. And systems thinkers who just talk about human systems as if it's just, they're all just another system. Well, you know, there's a systems of the people who make up the organization. Then you've got the production system and the, you know, socio-technical systems, that kind of language. It's around, but it's not as clear cut and as I think you know, conceptually satisfying as past distinction between P individuals and M individuals. So we can go up to the whole level of a society or a culture, where what makes it a society or a culture is that the participants, in one way or another, regard themselves, construe themselves as being members of that system. Now, this is where I disagree. This is where I don't buy into Luhmann's concept of social systems as systems of communications, which are separate from the conscious beings, the psychic systems.
I'm a fan of Luhmann as well as Pask, and I had a brief interaction with you just in the chat function during an online conference where I'm trying to reconcile the two, and I know that your feeling is that they are sort of ontologically incompatible. That's another conversation we can have that's maybe a little more sort of inside baseball, as they say, than for this particular podcast.
Yeah. Well,
but
just a brief couple of thoughts here.
Yeah, please.
I mean, Luhmann is taking his main theoretical structure from Talcott Parsons. And Parsons is, you know, a sociologist and interested in macro sociology, a theory. He wants to develop a theory of society, which is exactly what Luhmann wants to do too. He borrows all that from Parsons, and Parsons looks at societies as certainly Western societies as a set of functional subsystems which work together to keep society going. You know, the system of the law, the politics, you know, the military, whatever. You know, there are all these systems which function together to keep society going. So it's a kind of a macro theory of macro systems, and it's got a place for the human in there somewhere, but it's fairly peripheral. But Luhmann takes all that and just instead of where Parsons emphasizes what he calls action systems, where things get done, Luhmann emphasizes what he calls communication systems, where something is communicated. And in both cases, for Parsons, obviously, at the end of the day, it's human beings who are initiating the actions. And in Luhmann's case, it's the human beings who are the environment for the communications. They are passing them on or interpreting and so on. So at the level of wanting to have a macro theory of society with functional, which accounts for how functional subsystems emerge and how they interact together, Luhmann has another word for it, interpenetrate. Yeah. Well, if that's what you're doing as a macro sociologist, fine, but you don't all the other stuff about psychic systems and interaction systems is fairly peripheral.
Mm.
I've just been reading, I've got a name now, Esposito, Eleanor Esposito is one of the students. I just read an interview with her, and she gives a beautiful, clear account of how she uses the theory of functional subsystems and media and so on in Luhmann's theory. And I look at it, I think, well, you know, really it's still all isomorphic to Parsons.
Mm.
The other concepts, the psychic systems, are still conceptually trivial. It's just taken from a bit of Freud.
Mm.
And there's no serious development of the concept of social organizations like business organizations or other social institutions. It's useful at the level of macro sociology.
Mm. Mm.
And many theorists use it at that level.
Mm.
Yeah.
This is great. This is really helpful because I think that perhaps what I'm attempting to do is replace the Freudian notion of it always disappoints me when Freud shows up in Luhmann because I like so much of Luhmann, but when Freud shows up, I get a little disconcerted. That trying to replace the Freudian notion. So if the psychic system is the environment for the social system that Luhmann believes is constituted of these recursive communications, I guess maybe my hope is that the notion of the P individual could replace a Freudian notion of a description of the psychic system that enables Luhmann's communication system. So the environment are that we share a bunch of distinctions then they get instantiated in conversation. So that the P individual might be a new way to conceptualize the psychic system in Luhmann's thinking.
Well, the psychic system is taken from Freud, which is taken. Luhmann takes it from Parsons. Parsons takes it from Freud. It was the best kind of holistic psychology. It's the one that he knew about.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about Freud, the psychic system is it's what's happening psychologically that's embodied with all those drives and repressions and all that kind of motivational personality stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've got the Pascal concept of a psychological individual, you've got something much more powerful, and it's mm-hmm. embodied, of course, in the in the biological system, the brain-body system. So the source of emotions, feelings, and so on, all the stuff that you can find in Freud can be found in the concept of an embodied P individual.
Mm-hmm.
But the natural, which we've already discussed, is fairly straightforward. Kind of recursive fractal architecture of P individuals being subsets of other P individuals or supersets and so on. So the whole of society is one great P individual in the sense that members of society construe themselves as being part of society. And we're all part of that conversation if we choose to see ourselves that way.
Mm-hmm.
I find all we need is the what I call the psychosocial unity, which is the P individual in past terms, and the biomechanical unity, which is the M individual in past terms. So as we sit here, the M individual is all the material aspects, the brain-body system and all the biological stuff that goes on in there, including the brain functions and all that wonderful, wonderful stuff about the neurophysiology and the sensory motor system, which you get from Maturana and mm-hmm. Furster. So you've got all that biology. I'm also coupled to my environment in the sense I've got extensions. I'm wearing spectacles. I've got a computer in front of me, which is affording the conversation with you. I am a biomechanical unity as a material system and all that's around me. When I go and sit in my motor car becomes an extension of me. You know, as the psychological individual embodied in not just my body, but also in the car.
Mm-hmm.
These are very powerful ideas to sort of bring a simplicity and a unity to how we understand the human condition. And we only really need the biological or the biomechanical and the psychosocial, which captures, which is the psychological individual, the PASC. We don't need the tripartite distinction that Luhmann makes between communication systems, his social systems, and the psychic systems and biological systems. He has a tripartite distinction. Mm-hmm. In his past, we only need two.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I say, Luhmann goes on to distinguish between interaction systems, which are what we would call face-to-face conversations, and organizations, which are, as I say, institutions, business organizations, families, things like that, and these functional subsystems. His main interest is in the functional subsystems and the codes or media in which they communicate, on the basis of which they communicate. It's all very abstract, far away from the psychological, or the social psychological, come to that.
Right.
And and he uses that theory. He's got his theoretical structure, but he doesn't really develop his concepts of interaction systems. I mean, his ideas are just trivial compared to what you find in the richness of social psychology. His ideas about organizations, they're not developed. At one point, he says, the education system educates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like saying communication, only communication communicates. I mean, it's a kind of, to me, it's just a kind of, you know, pseudo-aphorism. You know, it's an affection of wisdom and insight, which that really doesn't bear examination.
Right.
If you want to do macro-sociology, functional subsystems, how law and politics interact, I mean, fine, but there's only about 5% of places on the planet where you can actually see those subsystems functionally differentiated. Everywhere else, it's dictatorships, corruption, greed. You know, there's no real distinction between these functional subsystems. It all gets down to something else.
Mm.
But it's interesting to think about how these subsystems emerge if you were to look at this functional analysis of how society works. And this is society as a macro system. This is Parsons, which is straight from which is Luhmann takes over.
Right.
Okay, so that's my.
All right. Well, I'm going to keep. I hear you loud and clear. I'm going to keep tinkering with my understanding and see if at some point I can throw something past you that you think maybe there's something here. You also we're running low on time. You've been so generous with your time. You sort of put cybernetics up against some other theories in the social world. You look at a comparison between what cybernetics offers alongside connectivism and actor network theory. And other things, but because we're running short on time, I want to get to your thoughts about the future. As it seems that this book then sort of moves us towards, you know, your maybe some of your desires or some of your hopes for the future, and what's in the part 10, which is called some socio-cybernetic understanding of possible world futures. So, can you just say a few things about that section as we move to a close, and what would your hopes be, your desires, or you think the possibilities are? Right. Of what socio-cybernetics could bring to a possible world future.
Okay. Chapter 10, part 2 or chapter 2 says, second section says, being holistic about global problems. So part of the theme is about being holistic. First of all, I'm taking for granted that there are global problems, there are serious problems at every level of society, not just globally, but also locally. And I also emphasize that this has been a concern of cyberneticians from the off. And we had Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson in the original MASIC conferences, both cultural anthropologists, and both seriously concerned about how the world works, how humans behave, you know, killing each other, all the nasty things that go on, and increasingly aware as others on the planet were that were, you know, well, it was well understood amongst most intellectuals on the biological and social side, or certainly in the cybernetics community, that we humans are destroying the planet. as well as continuing to, you know, kill and maim and enslave each other. So the problems have always been apparent, and you can find reference to these in various commentaries that have been made by von Furster, Pask, and McCullough, and Beer, certainly Beer, Stafford Beer, over the years. World in Torment, one of Stafford's most famous papers, sketches out this, you know, the dire situation that we're in. And I always said before, we've only got, you know, roughly 10% of the planet which can claim to be democratic. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, we are, you know, destroying our biosphere, which is a kind of collective noun for all possible ecosystems that can be distinguished. So those are the serious concerns. And Stafford Beer inspired me at one point when he says, in one of his lectures, he says, cybernetics is about being holistic. So we have to try to understand the whole. How can we? Because we are, you know, the challenge is that we are part of the whole, that we're trying to understand, whether we're trying to understand in some kind of philosophical, metaphysical sense, or we're just trying to understand in some pragmatic sense of what on earth do we do about all these problems. So in recent years, I formulated some, I call Scott's laws of observation and action, to help inform us of what the challenges are that we face. And they go as follows. There is always a bigger picture. It's an utter conceit to think that we ever know what's going on specifically, anywhere, locally or globally. There is always a bigger picture. Number two, there is always another level of detail. We can always drill down further and further and further down into the mysteries of whatever we want to contemplate as the ultimates, because we never reach them. Now here I'm thinking of quantum physics, which is a never-ending game of trying to understand the whole of which we are a part in another way. There is always another perspective, different ways of looking at the world. Everyone has their own perspective on what's happening. Law four, there's always error. We always make mistakes. No one's ultimately ever right. You only find lack of error in eternity, you know, in heaven or somewhere like that. And then the fifth law is there's always the unexpected.
Mm.
So as far and really, I became aware of the sort of global issues of to do with the environment and so on, pollution, whatever, in the late 60s and 70s. Early 70s, I saw a lecture from the ecologist Barry Commoner, and that really inspired me, and I've been thinking about it ever since, as of many other intellectuals. In fact, you know, a whole new discipline of ecology sprang up in various forms, and in the systems world, many people have devoted their work to, you know, systemic understandings of it. So I'm not original here in being concerned about these problems. I'm just saying, I'm saying we must look at them holistically, which is, in a sense, an impossible task, but we have our different perspectives and we need to converse together. We need to work together. So I make a distinction between the first order problems of what's happening materially around us, you know, the damage which is being done in various ways. And at the time when I first wrote the article that preceded this chapter, I didn't have pandemics on my list, which is rather ironic given what's happening at the moment. And then I name what I call second order problems with reference to von Furster's second order cybernetics, which is the cybernetics observing systems. If there's a complex first order world to all the systems, all the natural systems and so on, which are going on, and all the other sort of material work activity that happens on our planet. The second order problems are the interactions, social interactions, the individuation that's going on, and the conflict, lack of harmony amongst all that. And it really is hyper complex. We can sort of consider it from fairly macro levels of different competing belief systems and competing political systems, ideologies, and so on. And we can look down to the very micro level of why is it that my neighbour, for some reason, thinks that, as I discovered a few years ago, with one, you know, someone I had been introduced to, I discovered that she thought that black and white people are different species.
Mm-hmm.
So their level of ignorance, lack of understanding, different perspectives certainly, but lack of understanding at all levels, certainly locally. So there's so much to be done, or so much that is wrong, and depends on how I'm feeling on a particular day, whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic about the future. On a good day, I think, well, with the oncoming natural disasters, which are coming upon us faster and faster, and we're still barely waking up, certainly not at a global level waking up. There are fires and storms and floods everywhere, getting worse. And where will we be 10 years, 20 years? People say, oh, 50 years. No, it'll be 5 years, 10 years. We'll all be washed away, or many of us. So there's going to be disaster there. And given the lack of harmony amongst human beings, we don't know what else will go on. People are worried about nuclear war. I'm just concerned about the ongoing conflicts and oppression that goes on. You know, the slavery around mm-hmm. the world. There's a huge gaps between the rich and poor. And for heaven's sake, we've just had Richard Branson, a British mm-hmm. entrepreneur, made his living initially by selling LPs, final LPs by post. In the 60s and 70s. I mean, he had long hair, dressed like a hippie, but his beliefs and anything but what mm-hmm. he believed. And he's just put himself into space. Why? What kind of contribution is that to what's going on? Mm-hmm. That's apart from what, and we've got Jeff Bezos doing the same thing. That's mm-hmm. apart from what the nation states continue to do, the Chinese and the Americans and the Russians, the British, wanting to go into space. Spending billions and trillions on that sort of activity, well, we're facing all sorts of catastrophes and issues down here. So that's the big pictures that I'm concerned about, Tom. And mm-hmm. I hope cybernetics is not only a tool to help with solutions, as it already is, it exists, cybernetic concepts of feedback, feed forward, and so on, deeply embedded in ecology and increasingly in the understanding of the social world, thank heaven. We also have the real need to educate in the best mm-hmm. sense, to raise awareness. Just as one simple example, which disappoints me, makes me sad, is we have all this talk about race and racism. Race is not a scientific concept.
Mm.
There's no credibility to it anymore. It's used in local context by some physical anthropologists, I believe, but it doesn't have any scientific meaning. And yet, both racists and anti-racists, maintain the use of this, this trope, racism, and how do you penetrate into that? How do you try to educate people when you're they're burdened by these basically ignorant, misguided ways of thinking about what human beings are.
Would you suggest we use a word like prejudice or discrimination instead?
Exactly. Prejudice, discrimination,
mm-hmm.
Different ethnicities is a useful term.
But let's retire that word because its continuing existence only actually propagates this false distinction. Great. Well, thank you so much for the time you've given us, Bernard. The book is a real important contribution. I'll certainly be sharing it with many, many people. And it's been great to have you here on the podcast. Thanks again.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to share some of my thinking and also to have a very, I hope, productive conversation with you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.